the Mullick family. So, in Prabhupada's childhood, he learned Chanakya shlokas. Now, Chanakya, interestingly enough, Chanakya Pandit, I'm sure you've all heard of him. Chanakya was a pundit, another one of those pundits, and he was a Brahmana, but he was not a pure Vaishnava, Chanakya. He composed different moral instructions and even political guidelines. He was like kind of a Machiavelli. Have you heard of Machiavelli? How many people have heard of Machiavelli? Okay, the Italian politician. So Chanakya was, of course, far elevated than Machiavelli, although Machiavelli was associated with the church. He was a Catholic, but doesn't say much for the Catholic Church anyway. Chanakya Pandit was basically a Brahmana, but he was not a pure Vaishnava. But Prabhupada and every student, every young student in Bengal learned all the instructions of Chanakya. And some of them are brilliant. And even today in Delhi, the place where you get, where all the embassies are in Delhi, what is it called? Who knows? Even the Croatian and the Slovenian embassy, they're all there in Chanakya Puri. That area of Delhi is named after him. So he's very famous. So he made a statement about teachers and their students. He said, Lalane Bahavo Doshas Padane Bahavo Guna, which means if you pat your subordinate, that will simply increase his faults. Something like spare the rod, spoil the child. And then he said, Tasmat Sishyam Cha Chatram Cha Tadayanna Tu Lalayat. Either your son or disciple, you should always chastise them. Never give them lenience. And Prabhupada comments, so little leniency, immediately so many faults will grow. It's not bad to have someone who loves you enough to take the trouble to look at your character, to look at your life, and try to improve you. He may be expert or he may not be so expert. We hope that he's guided and helped by Krishna. We hope that he's patient and tries to work with his students nicely. But it is one of the duties of a teacher to chastise his students, to examine them, find out their faults. Guru means what? What does guru mean? What's the word? Heavy, right? Like Jayapataka Maharaj and myself, we're quite heavy, you know? Not that kind of heavy. It means heavy with knowledge, actually. But heavy with knowledge, it also, sadhu means one who cuts. The word sadhu means one who cuts away the gangrene of our mind and senses. So we should expect that when we take initiation into spiritual life, we should be prepared to be corrected. So Krishna starts, he says, Asochan anvasochas tvam pragyavadangs chabashase Gatasun agatasumscha nanu sochanti panditaha. that Arjuna, you have shown so much compassion. We discussed that. You can take down that first one, Bhagavan. See if you can pull it off. Yeah, just pull it off. We discussed finer sentiments. And what did we say about finer sentiments? What was the bottom line? What was the conclusion about finer sentiments like compassion, love, respect? Well, what did we talk about? Who can say? Huh? Put up your hand so I can... He knows, you know. Tell me. Huh? Frustration. No, the point about finer sentiments, they can be basically good things, but what's the problem? What was Arjuna's problem? He was compassionate. He was a good guy, you know. Why is Krishna chastising him? Arjuna was, you know, he was a real... The New Age people would have loved him, you know. I mean, he was really... Yes. Yes. Finer sentiments. Pardon, you said something? The sentiment. Well... Yes, they should be... Finer sentiments are good when they're used in the proper way. Arjuna's compassion was false compassion. False respect based upon some material motive. So Krishna's telling Arjuna that a learned man, he does not lament for the body. Krishna's beginning, he's going to destroy Arjuna's false compassion. He's chastising him. Now, one of the reasons, and this is very good, one of the reasons that a teacher will chastise his disciple is that he has to relieve the disciple of false ideas in his mind. Who knows the story that Prabhupada tells about the music school in Germany? Can anyone tell us that story? No? How many have heard the story before? The music school in Germany? No? I'm sure you've heard it. Ante. Oh. Mayapur, he knows everything because he travels with me. Okay, stand up. Stand up, stand up. Okay, tell the story.
The management of the school, of the music school in Germany, they take the students, so they put the condition, if someone has learned the music before, he has to pay double. Because...
If someone goes to him and two people go to him, and the first guy, they ask him, what's your experience in music? And he says, well, I've studied piano for 5 years, and I took violin for another 3 years, and I was a rock guitarist for another 3 years, and whatever. So they say, okay, that's good. We'd like to have you in our school. Your experience, your fee will be 100,000 kuna. And then the next person comes and says, they ask him the same question. He says, well... Actually, I'm really anxious to join your school, but I don't have any experience yet, to be honest with you. But I really want to learn. They'll say, okay, you're welcome also. Your fee will be 50,000 kuna. In other words, the guy who thinks he knows a lot, he has to pay double because they have to reteach him all the things that he thinks he knows, all the bad habits he has. So one of the reasons that a teacher will first of all examine the student and try to kind of purify him of his false conceptions is so that he can give him the actual truth, the real thing. So Krishna tells Arjuna that someone who is wise laments neither for the living nor the dead. For one who has life or one who has lost life. Asun and asun. A and a. So Arjuna's problem is that he's lamenting, so Krishna immediately says this is false lamentation. And then he says, Matra sparshas, pardon me, Natweva ham jatu nasam, in the 12th verse he says, Natweva ham jatu nasam, Natvam neme janadipa, Nachaiva navavishyama sarve vayam ataha param. So first of all, he tells him that the one should not lament for the body. And then he says, never was there a time, he starts talking about the eternal nature of the soul, he says, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. Now, this is actually, Krishna's doing a few things here. He's explaining to Arjuna that we're all eternal and you don't need to lament. You want to avoid fighting because you think that Bhishma and Drona and all of these other relatives of yours will cease to exist, but Krishna says, we will never cease to exist. We always existed. We are spirits. That's one thing he teaches him. But the second thing that he teaches him is more of an attack on Mayavadi philosophy. And it's subtle also because it has to do with Krishna establishing his position as a teacher. And this is important. If Krishna were just another ordinary conditioned soul, then the Bhagavad Gita would have no value. You can take this off. And you can take that off also. What is it about us that disqualifies us from being perfect teachers? We haven't taken the VIHE teacher training course, or what is it that, we haven't read Bhagavad Gita enough times? What is the one main thing that disqualifies us, the one tendency that we have that disqualifies us from being perfect teachers? Yes. Okay, tendency to forget, yes. Yes. Knowledge, we don't... Ignorance. Okay, unknowledge, that's... Okay, we're getting close here. We're getting hot. What do we have? Not two, but what? Four defects, right? So, why don't you write these down for me? Four defects. Huh? English. No, write defects up top there. So, how many of you are not initiated here in the tent? I want to know, get your names for afterward. No. Okay, I want you to answer this question. I want to see that people know the answers. I know that older devotees must know the answers. But what are the four defects that every human being has? Give me some answers. Put your hand up, yes. Yes, we have imperfect senses. Okay, Ante. Tendency to cheat. Fast. Okay. Yes. We are in a grand illusion. Okay, we're in tendency to be an illusion. Yes, Mataji. We make mistakes, yes. Isn't that unfortunate? Prabhupada used to say about this making mistakes, he used to tell examples. I know he'd use the same example all the time, but who knows what example he would use about making mistakes, yeah. Yeah, Mahatma Gandhi. Who else? He would say, "Your President Kennedy." He always talked about Kennedy. He didn't know much about John Lennon. John Lennon wasn't dead yet. But Kennedy was told not to go to Dallas. He was warned by the FBI and by various other people. They had wind of a plot, and that wind is still blowing. Even today they're talking about how Kennedy was killed. Something about some airplane that carried his body has disappeared now. They don't know where it is. They carried his body from Dallas back to Washington or wherever it went. Anyway, he talked about Kennedy because he was the president of the biggest country of the world. And he talked about Mahatma Gandhi, who everybody knew and respected. Gandhi was also told that he should not go to the prayer meeting, that they had news that somebody was going to shoot him. They didn't know who, but they had strong evidence. He was very stubborn, and he didn't follow advice. He made a mistake. Theoretically, you can do more when you're alive than when you're dead, right? So, we make mistakes. We have imperfect senses. You know, you can only see so fine, you can only hear so well, you can only taste so fine. One example I always give is of a dog whistle. There's a whistle that dog trainers have. I don't know if you've ever seen it here in Yugoslavia or former Yugoslavia. I'll say Yugoslavia because there's people from all over. Don't take offense, but... You'll be in a field, there'll be a dog trainer, and he'll have a dog, and the dog will be over there somewhere, and he'll get up and he'll blow on this whistle. And you'll think, the whistle doesn't work, you know, and then the dog will come running over. Because the dog, it was a very high-pitched, very, I don't know if you know this word, pitch, but, okay. Very high-pitched whistle. Only the dog can hear that range of sounds. So we have different degrees of perfection in our different senses. So this disqualifies us from acquiring perfect knowledge. And then we have a tendency to be an illusion. What's the biggest illusion that people have a tendency to be in? Okay, tell me something. No. Yes. Yes, that's the biggest, and we'll never die. We have the tendency to think that I am the body, and even a child can understand that. I've literally done this. I tell it story, but I've actually done it a number of times with little kids. You know, you play a game with them. This is my arm, or this is my hand, and you get all the kids to point to their hand. This is my arm, and they all point to their arm. This is my leg, and they all point to their leg. This is my head. This is my ear. This is myself. And then the kids start to laugh and giggle. And, you know, they all, you know, they can't figure out where to point their hand to. You know, I think it's funny. Try it next time you do a program at a junior at a university. No, wait, do it with young kids, you know, little five-year-old kids. And you'll see that they can discriminate between what is the body and what is not the, what is the self and what is not the self. Why don't we just, let's see. Okay. Throw that over. And write down knowledge, no ledge. What is the definition of knowledge? Prabhupada uses this in this section of the Bhagavad Gita, but it's also a general definition of knowledge. Anybody over here? You don't have the knowledge of what knowledge is? Okay. Anybody? Yes, Mataji? What is knowledge? Don't look in your book now. Yeah? Go ahead. You can only be wrong. I think we're getting pretty close there. Anybody else want to fill us in? What is knowledge? Okay, it's got all the answers here. Okay, it's the full thing is to know the difference between matter and spirit, to know the difference between the body and the self and the controller of both, which is more or less what you said, basically the same thing. You can write down knowledge, to know the difference between matter and spirit, and the controller of both. So, Krishna is trying to teach Arjuna this definition of knowledge, and he's describing the soul. Then he goes on. Okay, that's okay. Actually, we should, in the controller of both, try to make it big. Anyway, and the controller of both. Okay, why don't we? Okay, why don't we put this up on the over there? You know how to do this? No. It's got to be done with finesse, see? Yeah. So you got to be a professional. Okay. So then Krishna goes on. Okay, in verse 13 he says, it's the classic verse, famous verse, Dehino smin yatha dehe komaram yovanam jara tatha dehantara praptir diras tatra namuyati. We've got a very solid philosophy, a very logical, intelligent, rational philosophy. And this idea of reincarnation is very logical. There was a geneticist named Stephen Gould. He was also quite famous in the West for debunking or for going around and defeating. Gould, G-O-U-L-D. And he would go around fighting. He was a geneticist. He dealt with genetics. He was a scientist. And he went around fighting with the Christian creation scientists. Christian creation scientists. The Christian creation scientists were a group of educated, it's like the ISKCONs, like the BI. But, in other words, they were all qualified scientists, many of them big PhDs, etc., but they were Christians. And they were trying to somehow or other, they still are to this day, trying to say that the earth began 10,000 years ago in a big flood. And any, you know, reasonably convinced or, I'm trying to say, reasonably intelligent scientists can understand that the archaeological record just doesn't support that idea. The fossil records don't support 10,000 years. It's ridiculous. But because they're Christians, they have to somehow or other come up with an explanation. And they try their best. They have their different theories. Of course, we have a much, much more powerful explanation of the development of the material world. Of course, finally we come up with Lord Brahma, and that's a little hard to accept for some people, but along the way, all the different changes in material nature, the evolution of material nature, it's quite well documented in the Vedas, and it even comes close to agreeing with modern scientists in important places. But anyway, this Mr. Gould, he was always fighting with these Christian creation scientists, but he made a comment once that if there were anything that was reasonably logical, it was the Indian karma theory that made sense. So he was not a theist by any stretch of the imagination. You couldn't call him a theist. He was a hardcore materialist. But he said, at least on the basis of logic, Indian philosophy is rational. So here, this description, Dehino Smin, Yatha Dehe, if anybody tries to challenge you on reincarnation, from boyhood to youth to old age to death, there are so many changes of body. And this is not an Indian, sentiment, or it's not something that's only true in India. It's true everywhere. We go through stages from boyhood to youth to old age. It's just common sense. But the self remains the same, the I within the mind, the witnessing, experiencing person. So Krishna is telling Arjuna that the soul is going to survive the death of the body. Again, he's attacking Arjuna's sentiment, his false sentiment. And in text 14, Matra sparsas tu kontya sitoshna sukha dukada agama paino nityas tangs titikshas vabharata. Again, he explains a little bit about material nature, that there is happiness and distress, just like there's winter and summer. And you have to tolerate winter and summer. If it gets really hot in the summertime, There's nothing you can do about that. If it gets really cold in the winter time, you know, you can make some adjustments, but ultimately you have to tolerate the arrangement of nature. And similarly, in our lives, despite all our attempts to protect ourselves, we get good karma and we get bad karma. Good things happen to us and bad things happen to us. And formerly in our lives, we would just react to those things. And that we would be in distress. There'd be a lot of energy involved in trying to avoid stressful situations. But they would come, just like happiness would come on its own, similarly would distress. Krishna says his solution is that you have to learn to just tolerate, knowing that the soul is eternal and the body is destined to be destroyed. And in the purport, Prabhupada starts to talk about duties, prescribed duties that people have. And he gives the example of the month of Magh. When is the month of Magh? Huh? Yes, basically December, January. It's in the winter, basically. It's the cold season, the month of Magh. So what does... I'm sure you've all read the Bhagavad Gita. You've heard this before. What does Prabhupada say about taking bath in the month of Magh? We should avoid it, or... It's our duty. We have to take a bath. We have to keep clean somehow or other, even if the water's cold. Now, in the West, we have nice warm water, so we can try to avoid the distress. But in India, you just don't find, unless it's in wealthy people's homes, they have electric heaters, geysers. But in the common man's home, they just take the regular water. And in ISKCON, at least when we joined, it was almost a regulation to take a cold bath. A, it's good for your health, it's good for your nerves, it's good for your mind. And B, it's in the order of simplicity. It can purify you. So Prabhupada says that someone in the month of Magh has to still do their duty and take a cold bath. In other words, despite material inconveniences, one has to do his duty. He gives the example. What's the opposite of that example? He talks about something that happens in the summertime. Maybe some ladies know. Yes. Yes, ladies have to cook, even if it's the summertime, right? You can't just say, we're going out to dinner for the whole summer, you know, I'm not going to cook. It's hot in the kitchen, man, you know, it's like, in the summertime it's very hot, and I don't think any of you have air-conditioned kitchens, so... But still, the ladies have to do their duty. They have to tolerate the heat and cook. So these are examples. Prabhupada gives some other examples of prescribed duties which will purify us and keep our minds fixed. Prescribed duties keep us engaged, and they help us to actually advance spiritually. So, then in verse 15, Krishna says, Yam hi na vyatyantyete purusham purusharshava. Samadukha sukham dhiram somri tattvaya kalpate. That one who is not disturbed in happiness and distress and is steady in both is certainly eligible for liberation. So we want to take up spiritual life, and we want to get down to, you know, rasa katha, and we want all the nectar, and we want to, you know, listen to Leela all day long, and you know, have feasts and everything and all that good stuff that they promised us at the beginning. Dancing, chanting, and feasting. It's all fun, right? Well, it is, but there are a few little austerities along the way to prepare yourself to actually relish transcendental happiness. I can think of a corny example that comes to mind, but, you know, when I was young, I used to hate spinach. You know what spinach is? Shak. Okay, shak. That's the Bengali name. Everybody knows the Bengali name much better than the English name, right? What is spinach in Croatian? Huh? Spinach. Spinach. You know Popeye, the sailor? Yeah, okay. Okay, now everybody knows what spinach is. Popeye was made up for people like me, for kids like me, just to help mothers get their kids to eat spinach. That's why they invented Popeye, the sailor man. I hated spinach. I would smell it and I would start vomiting. But gradually, because it's a good vegetable for you, it's very healthy, I tried to, you know, learn to like it a little bit. But when I went to India, they actually showed how to cook it properly, and now it's one of my favorites. So, spiritual happiness is actually an acquired taste. It's like Prabhupada gives the example of what kind of sickness? Jaundice. What is the cure? Don't yell out, put your hand up. What is the cure for jaundice? Yes, sir, you haven't answered any questions. Sugar cane? Or sugar? Sugar. Sugar will probably rot your teeth out. Sugar cane is actually a little better. It's a purer form of sugar. In India, they use what they call Mishri, which is it's just crystallized sugar cane water. How many of you have lived in India? Anybody? Just two of you, three of you. Okay. Any ladies ever lived in India? How many? Okay, there's only three of you. How many of you have ever had jaundice before? Oh, three or four of you haven't lived in India. Okay, five or six haven't lived in India. In India, it's quite a common disease. And so, I mean, I've had jaundice at least two or three times. And of course, I lived there for 27 years, but anyway, when you take the sugar candy, what does it taste like? Yes, you. What does it taste like? Bitter, yes, it tastes very bitter. Amazingly enough, sugar, which is sweet, you know, you wouldn't think of making sweet rice without sugar, you know. Sometimes they put salt in the sweet rice by mistake. Have you ever had that happen? It has happened, and it's hellish. So, sweet, we all desire sweet. But when you've got jaundice and you take the sweet, it's bitter. But it's medicine, and you have to go on taking it. And within about a week, gradually it'll start to taste a little less bitter, gradually bland, and then it'll get sweet. And finally, when you're cured, it'll be its original sweetness. So spiritual happiness is something like that. It's an acquired taste, and you have to be prepared. You can't get frustrated on the first week or the first year or even the first 10 years if your bodily hairs are not standing on end. It takes time, maybe a whole lifetime, to cultivate the higher sentiments of bhakti. And prescribed duties are important for that, even though they may be inconvenient. Then Krishna goes on to describe, furthermore, he strengthens his arguments that the soul is not killed. He says, avinashi tutad vidhi yena sarvam idam tatam vinasham avyayasyasya. The soul is not destroyed, only the body is destroyed. That which pervades the entire body you should know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy the imperishable soul. Antavante me deha nityas yokta sharirina anashino prameyasya tasmad yudyasva bharata. The material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is sure to come to an end. Therefore, fight, O Arjuna. So, in the 18th verse here, he's telling Arjuna, he's just started. And he repeats this again and again throughout the chapter, but he just starts. This is the first time he says, therefore, fight. Do your duty. He's giving him philosophy, but the philosophy is aimed at getting Arjuna to act. Now, what example do we use about a sick person and activity and spiritual consciousness? A person with a boil, blowing on the boil. Well, that is one example. It's not what I'm looking for. Yes. Feeding a sick person, but he's got a fall. Were you trying? Are you talking to me, Mayapur? He's my doctor, so he feeds me all the time my medicine. Okay. No, yes, you. Yes, that's good. Well, the sick person has to follow the instructions of the doctor, but when is a person actually cured? Hanuman. When is he actually cured? He's sick. He's got to take time off work. He's tired. He's in bed and he's taking medicine. Huh? Yes, when he gets back up out of the convalescent bed. Convalescent bed, the, what's the word for convalescent in Croatian? Someone who's being cured, he's convalescing. So someone who gets back out of bed and engages in his regular activities again, then he's cured. So Krishna's telling Arjuna, he's giving him philosophy, but he's trying to get him to act again in his normal state as a kshatriya, because then he knows. And that's what actually happens at the end of the 10th chapter. Krishna, Arjuna says, that I now accept fully what you have taught me and I agree to fight. The end of the 10th chapter, practically, Arjuna has understood and he agrees to fight. Then Krishna goes on with some more arguments. Now this is something that if you have to debate with someone or convince someone of something, you make your initial argument and then you come to a little bit different angle and make another argument. And then you look at it from a different side and make another argument. And we're going to see in verses 31 through 38, Krishna even uses material argument. It's indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable, kill anyone or cause anyone to be killed. So, here he takes a little different track and tells Arjuna that Arjuna won't actually be killing, that the self is the body, and he won't be killing because the self is can't be killed. And he, Krishna, refers to, wipe it off. Krishna uses, he refers to an argument which Shankaracharya, it's there in the Chandogya Upanishad, it's there in the Upanishads, in the Vedas. It's called I feel like the lady at the gas station. Parinama. Parinama Vada. And this is an idea given by Veda Vyas that the soul is unchangeable. So Shankaracharya did not like this because he considered that if the soul were unchangeable, then that would suggest that Brahman, the individual souls, could never merge into Brahman because they could never be separated from Brahman. There's no question of merging back into something that you've never been separated from. So therefore he criticized Vedavyas and said that Vedavyas was wrong. He made a mistake. And of course Shankaracharya is none other than Lord Shiva, so we have the greatest respect for him. But he also has offended our guru, and we can't really tolerate that. Therefore we do not listen to Mayavadi philosophy, we do not associate with Mayavadis, and even the Madhvas, who are the biggest Sanskrit scholars in India, more or less, they're very heavy about the Mayavadis. They have a Sanskrit mantra. I should learn that mantra, actually. They, when they pass stool, they have a mantra that they chant, criticizing the Mayavadis. Has nothing to do with their stool, it has to do with criticizing the Mayavadis. But Lord Krishna explains that the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable. Immutable means unchangeable. Then he goes on, Vasamsi jirnani yathavihaya navani granati naroparani tathashira sharirani vihaya jirnani anyani samyati navani dehi. And this is a very famous verse. There's a lot of famous verses in this second chapter. Srila Prabhupada quoted them, and they're very powerful verses. Vasamsi, just like one changes his cloth when it gets old, so similarly the soul changes body. There's nothing amazing about reincarnation. It's about as amazing as you're going home tonight and changing your cloth. You know, you're not going to go home and, you know, take off your dhoti and, you know, put on a new dhoti tomorrow morning and say, wow, this is amazing, this is incredible philosophy, putting on a new dhoti, you know. Something you do every day. It's just common thing that you do. And Krishna says the soul changes body, and it's about as amazing as changing cloth. It's not that difficult to understand. And then he says, Nainam chindanti shastrani, nainam dahati pavakaha, nachainam kledyantyapo nashoshyati maruta. This is where he gets into this idea of the soul being... Now, he's attacking Mayavadi philosophy here. It's on the one hand, he's telling Arjuna that the soul cannot be cut by any weapon. The soul cannot be... What are some of the things he says? What does he say about the soul? Cannot be cut by a weapon. What else? Huh? I've got to turn around and... Okay. I'm sorry. Yes. Who? Burned by fire. Very good. Okay. Cannot be burned by fire. What else? From the gent side, yeah? Yes. Dried by wind. Okay. What else? Huh? Wet by water. Moistened is a big word. It's too hard for me to write. Wet by water. Voda. Okay. Yes, you had something here, someone? There, you had something? Hmm? Cannot be destroyed, but by what? Yes. Huh? Oh, cannot be cut. I think I said cut by weapon. Is there another cut in there? I think there's only one cut. Huh? Unbreakable, insoluble. Okay. It can't be dissolved. It's unbreakable. Unbreak. You can imagine A-B-L-E on the end here. Insoluble. Ooh. Okay, why don't we put this up? Over there. Just rip it off. How do you do? Hi. All right, let's have a good hand. Okay, good. He's coming professional. He's my disciple, so naturally I expect him to be. Why does Krishna mention all these things? Anybody got any idea? Yes.
To show the soul is eternal.
Huh?
To show the soul is eternal.
The soul is eternal. Okay, but... Why does... Yes.
I think he wants to show Arjuna not to be afraid.
Yes, Arjuna shouldn't be afraid, but why does he say the soul cannot be cut, it can't be burned, it can't be dried, it can't be wet by water? What specific reason is
it? Arjuna's afraid. Arjuna has different weapons. Powerful, like
what? Yes, Arjuna has different kinds of weapons. He's got a bow and arrow, he's got a sword, he's got a club. What else? He has mantra weapons. You guys are just doing mantra japa, but when you really get going, we're going to teach you all about mantra weapons. You don't have to worry about any more third world war or anything. You can just throw an Agni Astra at the Americans or at NATO or something, you know. Just throw a Pashupata. They had very highly developed weaponry based on sound. You know, just like Pavarotti, he's got a highly developed weapon. These singers, they can actually break glass by their high-pitched voice. I've seen it done. You know, glass breaks. You ever seen that? Anybody ever seen that? On television, right? You heard of it. Thomas Love's heard about it. Next time it's on television, someone call him up so he can see about it. Arjuna had all these weapons that he could actually burn the soul. He could wet, he had a wind weapon, he had a water weapon, he had a mountain weapon. So Krishna's trying to tell Arjuna that even these weapons used in battle will not kill Drona and Bhishma and Kripa and Dhritarashtra and Karna and all these others. Nobody will be killed. Okay. Should we go on, or how many would like to go on? Okay. Actually, if you don't want to go on, then you can go on. Okay. I just have a few more verses, so I'll try to finish this section. Krishna says, oh yes, in this section, this is interesting, from verses 26 through 30, Krishna's different angle of vision is, what if there is no soul anyway? Some people say there is no soul. You know, they talk about the ghost in the machine. They refer to people who think of the soul as being something as just foolish sentimentalists who believe in a ghost. The ghost, the ethereal ghost, you can't see the soul. What argument do we have about not being able to see the soul? What do you say when someone says you can't see the soul? You just say, gee, you defeated me, you've got to go home now. And what do you say? Ante, what do you say? Take some prasadam? No. What?
That since soul is spiritual and our eyes are material, it's logical that we cannot see it.
Okay, that's a belief argument. The soul is spiritual. Yes, in the back. Yes. Very good. I haven't used that one, actually. That's very good. You can't see radio waves, but you know they exist. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to rock and roll, right? Jagannath is one. Where's Ganso? Is he around? Okay. Yes, Mataji. That's a good argument, but I could say that there's no soul, it's just chemicals that moves the body. Huh? Don't get flustered. You've got me cornered now, but I'm just fighting to get out of the corner.
Where
did
the concept come from?
Huh? Well, the actual argument is that at the time of death, the chemicals are still there. All the chemicals are still there. So you could have defeated me there, but there's another seeing argument which is very popular. Yes. Love? Can't see love? Emotions, yeah. But we know they exist, and they do have power. Yes? Tip of a hair, 10... Okay, well, that's not an argument. That's just a belief. Yeah. Okay, that's a nice argument. In fact, someone, Nityodita Swami, was just in Ljubljana, and he went to some caves or something. It's the only thing to see in all of Slovenia. I don't know. What's it called?
Postenskayama.
You know that place? How many people have been there? Yeah? Okay. I haven't been there. I've been going there for years, and nobody's offered to take me there. I'm really hurt. Nityodita Swami goes there once. And but he said, anyway, they were in this cave, and then all of a sudden they turned all the lights out. And he said it was dark. It was not just dark. It was really pitch black dark. And he couldn't even see his hand. You know, we use the example, you can't see your hand 2 feet in front of your face. So what is your power to see the soul? Can't even see your own hand. Well, I was referring more to, yes, cannot see air, but we know it's blowing. Yes. By its symptoms. Hey, you guys are great preachers. You got a lot of arguments here. Standards, a powerful philosophy Prabhupada gives us. You'd like to, why don't you repeat that?
We cannot see the soul, but we can perceive it by its symptom, consciousness, just like we cannot see the sun. But because it is bright light, we know it's there in the sky.
What do we see?
We see a symptom of the sun, or the light, sunlight.
Sunshine. Okay. The argument I was looking for was actually inferior to all the ones you've used, but I usually tell people you can't see, because I like to sound technical, you know, the techno-guru. But you can't see electrons. You see, in a, the way they demonstrate electrons that they exist is in a cloud chamber, a glass chamber that's filled with gas. Call it a cloud chamber, and then they'll run electrons from a positive to negative electrodes across a vacuum or whatever, and then you see a tracer. You won't see the electrons, but you'll just see a white kind of, like you see the jets fly in the sky. The jet's probably out of your sight, but you see a trailer of smoke. So in a cloud chamber, you don't see the electrons even there, but you see the symptom of the electrons passing through. So there's many, many arguments that we can give for the existence of the soul. And, I mean, it's just amazing. The real problem, you know, the real problem is we've got to make more arrangements to be able to somehow or other lure people, attract people, so that we can sit down and talk to them. One of the very best means of preaching that I know of, which you're probably relatively ready to engage in Yugoslavia. It's not the Muslim strategy of sword in one hand and Quran in the other, but You have a lot of congregational devotees who are starting to build their houses or build their apartments or whatever. It takes a lot of energy. You can ask, a book distributor was initiated today. What is his name? Slovenian Jaipataka Maharaj initiated one. Vasudeva Dutta. Yeah? Yeah? Is he here today? Nope. Probably with his Guru Maharaj, but... How many of you have been book distributors in your life? Yeah? Quite a few of you. It's hard to get out of the van and go out and do books, isn't it? Initially, they do a video in Los Angeles a day in the life of a book distributor, and there's a little description there how they're having a discussion with a book distributor, and he's telling how actually in the early morning he's really got to get his mind enthusiastic, because there's a natural kind of lethargy or fear. I don't want to go out and talk to others and maybe they'll argue with me, or maybe I'll get embarrassed, or, in Kali Yuga we want to remain isolated and internal, protected. We don't want to open ourselves up to any danger. We've been hurt too many times before. So with preaching, it's hard for us a little bit to go out and preach. But any book distributor can tell you that once you start doing it, it's amazing the feeling you get and how Krishna helps you and Krishna guides you and Krishna encourages you in so many ways, and you feel very wonderful about preaching and book distribution. So another way that you can do that, which is much softer, is why don't you invite people into your homes for a little prasadam? It's a very powerful way of preaching. Supposing you're working at a job somewhere, and you're talking a little bit here and there with people, and you meet someone who shows a little interest. Why not invite them home to your house for dinner? Not, once you come to my house, I want to convert you to become a hard... Not like that. But why don't you... I'm just learning Indian cooking, and it's really, really good vegetarian food. I really like to have you over for dinner. You think you and your husband could come over for dinner? Or even, you think you and your boyfriend could come over for dinner? That's cool. And then have them over for dinner and give them prasadam, and don't even preach, just make friendship with them. And a little soft preaching, and gradually build up a relationship with them. And this is a very powerful way of preaching. I think it's the next stage of evolution in our preaching. And this announcement was paid for by the Namahata Sangha ministry in Croatia. No, I believe in Namahata preaching. It's really a powerful thing. And we should use that as much as possible. Okay. So, then Krishna says, Atha chayanam nitya jatam nityam va manyase mritam tathapi tvam maha baho. Where's Mahabahu? Mahabahu. Is he here today? Oh, there he is. Stand up. Take a bow. Okay. Show us those arms. Krishna uses this name, Mahabaho, a few times in the Bhagavad Gita. Oh, mighty-armed Arjuna. It's interesting. He calls him, oh, mighty-armed Arjuna. And then he says, Nainam Sochitum Arhasi. There's no need to lament, mighty-armed. In other words, it's a little bit, using a little cynicism. You're supposed to be a big warrior, but here you are crying and lamenting. And a teacher really has to sometimes push. And sometimes people object to this. They want a guru who just tiptoes through the tulips and, smiles all the time and and never tells you to come to Mangalarti and never bothers you about the four regulative principles, that's not going to get you back to Godhead. You need someone who will actually devise ways and means to push you a little bit in Krishna consciousness. Then Krishna says, Jatasya hi dhruvo mitya dhruvam janma mrityasya cha tasmad aparihariye ritena tvam sochitum arhasi. Again, natvam sochitum arhasi. There's no need to lament. One who has taken his birth is bound to die, and after death one is sure to take birth again. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, you see, Krishna's taking a whole different, first of all, from 11 to 25, Krishna's talking about the eternal nature of the soul. Now he's talking more about duty to Arjuna, and saying that you can't avoid your duty, you can't avoid the death of the body, therefore fight. You should not lament. Avyakta dini bhutani, vyakta madhyani bharata, vyakta nidananyeva tatraka paridevana. All created beings are unmanifest in their beginning, manifest in their interim state, and unmanifest again when annihilated. Now this is a very, very interesting concept. That all living beings are unmanifested in the beginning. Before we took birth, you know, what do you do sometimes with little children? A 2-year-old kid, you know, or 3-year-old, they know how to talk a little bit, they recognize people, and you're talking with them, playing with them, and you say, how old are you? And I'm twee, you know, I'm 2 years old, you know, and oh, that's very nice. Where were you 4 years ago? And they, you know, they get a little stunned and they start to think about it. I've had kids say I was in mommy's tummy. Those are the smarter ones, but usually they get bewildered because where was I? I'm 3 now, but where was I 4 years ago? We were in an unmanifested state. Maybe we were, you know, spending some time in Yamaraja's place, having prasadam with him, getting the mercy. There's a nice description how Papa Purusha was, how Ekadasi, why it's... you know, sinful to eat grains on Ekadasi. There's a description from the Puranas that Krishna created this. He created living beings, but they were not disciplined very well. They were acting sinfully. And so he created Papa Purusha to... chastise the sinful living beings. But then he thought, this Papa Purusha may be able to exercise too much control over the living beings based upon his own whimsy, upon his own ideas. So then he created Yamaraj to regulate the punishment that was meted out to sinful living beings. Now, if I got that right, I think I made a mistake here. Papa Purusha, there was someone else in the picture there. Can't remember. Anyway, the point was that after Krishna had created Yamaraj, I'll come back to you on this one tomorrow, get my facts straight. Okay. It's nothing more embarrassing than starting into a story and then getting everything wrong and having it on video, and you want to destroy the video after the program. Krishna went to see Yamaraj And Yamaraj welcomed him in his palace and was serving him and everything. And then Krishna started to hear all this screaming and yelling and, you know, so many far out noises. And so then Krishna said to Yamaraj, "What's that?" And Yamaraj said, "Well, those are the living beings. They're being punished." And so then Krishna went to see, and he was quite disturbed, quite distressed about the suffering condition. And eventually he made some arrangement where the living beings could get freed from their sinful reactions. But anyway, we're unmanifest. When we die, we do go to the court of Yamaraj to Daivanitrena, Karmana, Daivanitrena, to see about our next birth, which is decided by Yamaraj. He has a giant mainframe computer that everybody... It's amazing. Yamaraj keeps complete track of every activity of every living being. Amazing. But... So then we're manifest, we become born, we're manifest, and then after a certain period we're unmanifest. And this cycle is going on, so Krishna tells Arjuna, there's no need for worry, this is going to go on. One who is born, death is certain. And one who has died, birth is certain. The cycle is going on. It's a circle, it's called a chakra. A wheel of birth and death. Now, try to find the end of a circle. There's no end to it. It just keeps going around and around and around. There's no last stop in a circle. A line goes from here to here, and you get to here, and that's the end of the line. But a circle, and birth and death are going on like that. And Krishna says, Arjuna, there's no need to lament. And then in verse 29, he talks, actually 27 through 28, he's kind of talking about munis and their speculations, that they get bewildered. Pardon me, this is in 29. He says, Acharyavad paschati kaschit enam, Acharyavad vadati tataiva chanya, Acharyavad chainam anya shrinoti, Shrutvapi enam vedana chaiva kaschit. Some hear of the soul is amazing, some look on the soul is amazing, some describe him as amazing, some hear of him as amazing, while others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. In the purport, Prabhupada talks about munis who love to speculate on the nature of existence. And what's the characteristic of munis? They sell flowers, I know. Yeah. Huh? Huh? Everybody's got an answer. It's hard for me to hear. I'll just hear from
them. They have their own philosophy.
They all have their own philosophy. Why? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You can't be famous by repeating what everybody else is saying. You've got to come up with something new, something different, something interesting, something unique. So munis do that. I had this experience once. I went with Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj to meet scientists, and scientists are kind of munis. So he was getting people to attend the World Congress for the Synthesis of Science and Religion in Bombay, in Prabhupada's centennial. And we met this very big scientist in London. So while we were talking to him, Swarup Damodar Maharaj happened while trying to encourage him to come to the conference. I think he was either a Nobel laureate or he was one of the top people in his field in science. So trying to encourage him, Swarup Damodar Maharaj said, "And oh, by the way, another man who works in your field, so-and-so in France, is also thinking of coming." And I was shocked. The man completely changed his demeanor, demeanor. You know what demeanor means? Okay, his way of dealing with us, his mood, the whole mood changed. He immediately became angry. He said, "Oh, that guy, he hasn't done anything. He doesn't know anything. His experiments are all bogus, and I know much, much more than him." You know, you're supposed to be a cultured scientist, a leader of the community, and here he was showing such anger. Because the scientists, they all compete with one another to come up with different theories. They're kind of like Moonies. And they're really motivated because they get money from governments and from big industrial complexes, industrial companies, corporations, based upon their research work and what new things they come up with. They get grant money, and that's how they pay their, liquor bills and how they pay their family bills and whatnot. So they're not learned people. They're not scholars. They're just Moonies. And they, such type of people can never understand the soul. They'll always be bewildered. Because the knowledge about the soul is eternal. The soul is eternal, and the knowledge, we're not trying to present something new to people. This is another big problem that we have with preaching. And that is that in preaching, sometimes ego enters into our preaching a little bit. Sometimes we try to impress people more than really trying to give people Srila Prabhupada. We want to show people that we are superior. You know, we shave our heads, we wear kanti mala, we wear bed sheets and put bird goo on our foreheads, and we're superior. You know, we feel a little embarrassed about being about our culture, because our culture's not so well known in the West. I just read an article on Calm about a temple that opened in Idaho, Boise, Idaho, which is a little small town, and maybe a couple of hundred thousand town in Boise, Idaho. In America, Idaho is a state where they grow potatoes, if that means anything to you. But it's not a very famous state. Boise's not a very famous town or city. But there was this beautiful article about a temple, a Hare Krishna temple that was opening. And I suspected that one of the reasons that they were giving a lot of, the local newspaper was giving a lot of respect to the temple opening, was because the man who founded the temple was an ISKCON devotee, obviously, and he was one of the senior workers at Hewlett-Packard organization. He was a senior scientist at Hewlett-Packard, and his son had just graduated from college with a straight A, what they call it, 4.0 average. He was 17 years old. He was 17. He was a brilliant. It means he started college when he was like 12 or 13, and he was heading off to Oxford to take up postgraduate studies, and his brother was 15 and he was just, you know, finishing his degree. So when you meet those kind of people, it's hard to just say that they're foolish, brainwashed, ignorant, you know, and they're 10 times better at everything you can do. They're 10 times better than you at it. They're better scientists, they're better philosophers, they're better computer programmers. So one of the problems we have is trying to show our superiority in our preaching, and we sometimes say things which are a little bit beyond our own level of realization, and that may be a mistake. It's sometimes better to keep your preaching very simple and from the heart and things that you actually know, because it is hard for people to understand our philosophy. Some look on the soul as amazing, some hear of them as amazing, and many people, even after getting information, can't understand. And then in the last verse, Dehi Nityam Abhadyoyam Dehe Sarvasya Bharata Tasmat Sarvani Bhutani Natvam Sochitum Arasi, the same idea about the soul being distinct, indestructible, and living in the body. Some points in the chapter, in this section, again, the theme, the spirit soul is eternal, indestructible, while the material body is temporary. Because of this, one should not be bewildered by the inevitable destruction of the material body. Rather, one should remain fixed in prescribed duties which purify and allow one to realize the eternal self. And the teacher, first of all, will often chastise the disciple to break down his misconceptions. Krishna consciousness is presented, Arjuna has presented many intellectual arguments to avoid fighting, but he didn't consider the eternal nature of the soul, and therefore his arguments sounded intellectual, but they were actually foolish, so Krishna chastised him. Prescribed duties are essential for spiritual advancement, that's mentioned there. There's two really important things about prescribed duties. And I want to write this down here because I think it's something that, you know, for most of the year we don't attend summer camp or go swimming or, you know, we have a lot of festivals, but the better part of the year is just based in our regular day-to-day services, whether it be cooking or pujari or management or whatever. And there may be a tendency to not be so enthusiastic. You know, you come here, you get all fired up and enthusiastic, and you go back and gradually your enthusiasm wanes. Like the moon waxing and waning. So waning, it gets weaker and weaker, your enthusiasm. So there's two things about prescribed duties, two advantages to them. One, what do prescribed duties allow us to work through? They allow us to do something that we really need to do in our lives. What are the four purusharthas, the four things about human life? Who knows what they are? Purusharthas. You heard this word before? Okay. Why don't you write this on the board? Give you something to do. Purusha-artha. You know how to spell that, right? Purusharthas, okay. No, I think that's I think not in this photo. Oh, you're right. What are the four Purusharthas? Okay, behind Ante. No, the behind you. Yes. Huh? Loudly, say it loudly. Stand up, you're a big man. Say it loudly.